No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Hello, and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you should feel free to call in with questions at 888-627-6008. Tonight we have a very special guest, but first let me say hello, Marilia. How are you?
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. Did you get this the walk shoveled? And, you know, we had a catastrophe.
I did a lot of shoveling and a lot of taking that really heavy snow off the trees and bushes, and I love it because it's great exercise and I love the snow.
Yeah, well, you're, you know, in Washington, more than two inches of snow throws us into a panic. You can't find a bottle of milk or a loaf of bread, but I'm glad you made it all right. And tonight we have with us just an iconic journalist here in Washington, D.C., Eleanor Clift, who is now writes for the Daily Beast, but for many years was on one of my favorite TV shows on PBS, The McLaughlin Group. And we're honored to have you with us, Eleanor. Thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah, and thanks for being back. You've been on once before, so we very much appreciate it. And you've recently written an article. Let's start there. You've written an article in the Daily Beast about the 17 judicial vacancies we have here in the District of Columbia. Almost a quarter of all the seats, a third of all the appellate court judges that are not being approved by the United States Senate. For our listeners who may not know this, the District of Columbia, one of the further injuries that we suffer by not being a state is that the United States Senate has to approve our judicial nominees, and they haven't done that. And this
That's
is
right.
a real especially as you point out in your article, with the rise in gun violence in the district. You know, we've got an increase, I think it's 18% in murders in the District of Columbia, more gun violence than we've ever seen before. You write in your article, which really surprised me, that the head of the D.C. Democratic Party, a guy that I know well, took his kids trick-or-treating in a better part of the city. He lives in Anacostia, which is ground zero for a lot of gun violence. And while he was out, two bullets hit his house. I mean, just incredible, is it not?
Right. Well, what caught my eye was a piece in the Washington Post on Sunday. Let's see, it was right... Sunday, January, so it was after the new year, and it was titled Alarm Sounded on D.C. Judges. And if you read through the article, way, way buried in the article is this mention that the Democratic Party chair in the District of Columbia, Charles E. Wilson, took his kids across town trick-or-treating because, as you pointed out, in Anacostia, where he lives, gun violence is all too common. And when he got back home, he discovered that there were random gunshots right around in his neighborhood, and two of them actually hit his house. So he had made the right choice. Well, when I commented about this to my editor that morning, he quickly Googled this incident to see if it had been written about anywhere else, and it hadn't been, which is, and Halloween was, of course, the end of another month earlier in the year, and this was the first time this had been mentioned. And so it was mentioned in the context of this crisis of vacant seats in the D.C. courts. Now, when the Senate adjourned for the holidays, they approved by voice vote more than a dozen federal lifetime judges that Biden had nominated. And everybody was, you know, cheering about that. And I wrote about that, too, because that was a great victory. But they didn't confirm a single judge for these D.C. courts, because these are not lifetime positions. They're 15-year term-limited positions, and they're federal judges in the sense that they are nominated by the president and they are confirmed by the Senate, but they are local judges. They are our state courts, and so in no other state in the country are state courts subject to the whim of U.S. senators. And the reason the Senate didn't confirm a single judge for the District of Columbia was because Florida Senator Rick Scott, had decided that he was just going to score some cheap political points. And so he refused to join in the voice vote, which has to be done by unanimous consent. And he said, "I have absolutely no faith that Joe Biden's radical far-left nominees will uphold the rule of law." And with that, the District of Columbia didn't get any judges to fill these 17 vacancies, 14 on the Superior Court and 3 on the Appeals Court. So I thought it was pretty shocking. And so I wrote about it, and, you know, Republicans like to call for law and order, but, you know, if they don't give us the judges, where are we going to get the law and order? And the district is losing the fight against gun crime. There are ghost guns and guns flooding in from Virginia, which has very scant regulation. And you can't prosecute violent people if the courts aren't working. And you also can't do a lot of the other sort of business of life. I mean, child custody fights, divorces, property disputes. I mean, if the courts aren't working. So I think it's pretty significant. And the judges that are appointed are not, you know, they're not controversial people. They're sort of qualified people that come through Republican and Democratic administrations. And both parties actually agree that these seats need to be filled. And so why is it not happening? Because the politics values lifetime federal judicial appointments more than they value filling the D.C. courts. And so it's that second-class citizenship that those of us who live in the district experience all the time. So, you know, it's another sort of slap in the face of 700,000 D.C. residents that their court system isn't allowed to function on the level that it should, because we just don't count as much as, I would say, sort of regular states. I mean, we function like a state in many ways, but we don't have statehood.
Well, you know, before I let my brilliant co-host ask a question, let me just add to that so that people understand. There are 10,000 criminal cases pending in the District of Columbia. This is, as you point out, Eleanor, this is a serious problem. And, you know, we have a problem as a local community in connecting the dots for, you know, what we suffer by not being a state. But this is one of the significant things that we do suffer. Marilia, do you have a question for Eleanor?
Well, you point out about the number of the cases. The courts have just recently started to hold trials again, the criminal courts. So they're way, way behind. And you know, this makes it more difficult, because you don't have the personnel, if you will, to prosecute the crimes. So it's bizarre. It's bizarre that that the District of Columbia has to, you know, go to the back of the line to take care of its criminals and to take care of the ordinary business of life that ends up in the courts. And you know, I started the article putting the spotlight on Charles E. Wilson, who the gentleman who took his kids across town and then came back and tweeted that he tweeted took the kids to safer hood because of gun violence. On the way home, got pictures from my neighbor. 8 shots and 2 hit the house. 1 bullet in kids' room. This is not okay or normal. This must stop. The Washington Post pointed out that that was his way of sending a message to the mayor and to the D.C. council. But it's not that Wilson just wants more police. I mean, he wants smarter government. He wants government. And to get the courts filled and functional is the seems to me is the least that government writ large can do to serve the people. And what you pointed out about the backlog of criminal cases, it's they've got a backlog under the best of times. And when you have this kind of leadership crisis, there's no way. I mean, there are more people now spending time waiting for their trial than they would spend if they were convicted. And I mean, that's how the timing is so out of kilter.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's ironic too, because you've got Republicans always saying to me, Eleanor, you don't need voting representation because you have 535 people that represent you in Congress already, because we all live here, which is just nonsense, you know. And Rick right. Scott, by the way, is a classic D.C. hater. We deal with problems from Senator Scott all the time. But really,
well, that's interesting. You know, so why does he have a bee in his bonnet about the District of Columbia? Is it just kind of a cheap, you know, political shot?
But yeah, we're all, well, 2 reasons, I think. One is that if you want to cause a problem and you do it in the District of Columbia, it gets noticed. So you can't, if you're a congressman from Texas, you can't reform the gun laws in Texas. You can't make them any more liberal because they're so liberal. So you want to build up points with the NRA, you attack the gun laws in D.C., and that makes front page news, and you know, and it ups your street creds with the National Rifle Association. That's one reason. And another reason is we're all Democrats, and they just hate us for that. They don't want to do anything for us. Now let's hear from Marilli, who's not a Democrat. What do you think, Marilli? Can you hear us? We're having a few communication problems.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add to that about the judicial nominations, that the court system is backed up as it is also because of COVID. Judges are sitting home issuing decisions and looking at cases away from their clerks who are all sitting home, and they barely even see each other. So it's extremely inefficient, and it's adding to this backlog. And people have a choice of whether or not they want a jury trial. Jurors, you know, can't come because they're sick. They have to separate jurors. There's just a lot of huge inefficiencies adding to this backlog because the judicial nominations are not happening. It's really appalling.
Yeah, and
I want to give a shout out to a gentleman named Douglas Buchanan, who is the communications person who speaks for the courts, and he's actually new to the job. He came to it last year after his predecessor in that job retired after, you know, some 20 years. And Buchanan, as he said to me on the phone, he said, "I came over from the fire department," and he was kind of shocked at these vacancies, some of them quite long-standing. And as I said earlier, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, agree these seats have to be filled. But neither side is vested enough politically to make it happen. The Democrats, because they got bigger fish to fry in getting these federal judges seated lifetime, and Republicans, because it's just low on their priority list. So and the D.C. is like a punching bag. They like to hit at it every so often. But so Douglas Buchanan wrote this really long piece to the Washington Post, which he then forwarded to me, basically making the case that this is an emergency. And he came over from the fire department, so he uses the lingo. He said, "I decided I had to sound the alarm." And if he didn't point it out, I'm not so sure anybody else would have said anything. The D.C., the mayor and the council, pointing out to the problems in the courts gives them sort of a convenient way to, you know, blame the fact that crime has risen in the district. And, you know, crime has risen for a variety of reasons, and the backlog in the courts certainly doesn't help, but it's not the sole reason. And the issue just doesn't seem to get the attention that it should. But as Senator Brown pointed out a little while ago, I think there are 10,000 criminal cases currently pending in the D.C. Superior Court, which is more than double last year's caseload at the same time. And there are 14 vacancies out of the 62 judges that sit in that court. And the Court of Appeals in the district is 9 judges, and there are 3 vacancies, which means that that translates into 200 cases per year will be delayed because of a decrease in the number of panels that can be constituted. So this has, you know, real life effects on people's lives. It's not some abstract number, an abstract situation. And these courts, you know, I didn't really understand it, that they're term limited for 15 years. They're like courts in other states where the governor would nominate people, but the mayor here doesn't have any control, so the Congress has veto power, or really, I guess you could call it staying power or slowing power. They can just make everything, you know, slow up for a considerable amount of time. Some of these vacancies have been there for years. It's a mess, and I'm not the only one who uses that word. The councilman who heads the Judiciary Committee in the district has called it a mess. Now you're familiar with him, I'm sure, Senator Brown.
Oh, Valen, yeah.
And
you know that, again, I think one of the reasons that we don't, you know, I think it's important that you write articles like the one you wrote, because Marilia lives in Ward 2, I live in Ward 3. You know, when it comes to statehood and some of those issues, we're the most powerful wards in the city, and you know, we have a pretty good life, right? We have good schools, we're yep. safe, we have, you know, so we don't worry about these things the way we should worry about them. And, right. you know, statehood, unfortunately, I believe, for the people of District Columbia is like world peace. We do a survey and we say, do you believe in statehood? And they said, yes. Just like if we asked you, do you believe in world peace? You would probably say yes. But are you willing to expend any political capital to get there? Or, you know, what are you willing to do? You know, we don't worry so much about these things. And today in the Washington Post, there's another article. And what are they worried about? They're railing on Ted Cruz. Not that I'm against railing on Ted Cruz, but they're railing on him because he wants to affect the He wants to get rid of the mandate that the mayor is trying to put in effect for school children to go to D.C. public schools to be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And crazy as it seems, any member of Congress can do this. You don't have to be special. You don't have to be on a committee or anything. You can, any one of them can interfere with our business in the District of Columbia. But this is what upsets people, right?
Because Senator Cruz said he's going to introduce this. Now, whether he really does introduce it and whether it really does pass, you know, he's wanting to score political points just to do it. But when you think about he's the guy who fled Texas when they had their weather problems and went off to I guess it was Cancun, going to Cancun, saying he was just going overnight, but he had a pretty big suitcase. So that he, coming from Texas, as you pointed out earlier, he can't make the laws in Texas any more conservative than they are. So he comes to the district and sees if he can't block the mandate, proposed mandate. Well, the mandate, I think she's put it in place. I think it takes effect in March. That school kids have to be vaccinated.
That's right.
I think it's the right decision. Yeah. And we vaccinate our kids for lots of other things. So we shouldn't do that.
Yeah,
and
sure
we should point out that Eleanor Holmes Norton does have legislation that would address this, which would address the backlog in the judicial appointees, which is a very simple thing. And it would just impose the same restrictions on appointing judges as is already in place for legislation that affects the district. And that is, if nobody objects over 30 working days, it becomes law. And so if nobody objects to the nominees that the president of either party, whoever is in the White House at the time, puts forward, they would automatically take their seats. It would, so they wouldn't have to submit to Senate confirmation, which no other state courts in the country have to submit to. Seems to me an easy fix, but nothing is easy to get through this Congress.
It's not. We should point out that in the past, similar types of legislation put forth by our non-voting delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, she's been pretty successful in getting several of them through. So, you know, the hope would be she'd be able to get this D.C. Vacancy Reduction Act passed, we hope. Anyway, Marilia, I feel like I'm monopolizing the
conversation. No, I'm thoroughly enjoying listening to you, as always, and of course, listening to Eleanor, as I have for several years, ever since the mid-'80s, when I used to watch the Auckland Group. So,
right.
As a child, when you used to watch the McLaughlin Group. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Eleanor, for all your wisdom and your knowledge and sagacity over the years. Really, you've added and continue to add much needed positive view on things and the right view on things.
Thank you. I was with Newsweek for many years, and I was a reporter, so I do believe in facts and information, and so the way we're so now completely driven by, you know, opinion and attitude, so that facts become disposable things or things that some people think they can just change willy-nilly. It's very disturbing. I don't know quite how to turn it around either. As we head into this year where we're fighting a lie that has now been embedded into the body politic of that somehow the 2020 election was not legitimate. And I applaud President Biden for addressing it in a very forceful way in the speech that he gave on January 6th. And I'm thinking now that the earlier strategy to sort of not give the former president much attention, to not mention his name, to assume that nobody could get away with calling the 2020 election a rigged election when it's been examined and reexamined and audits in multiple states, thinking that that could not possibly take hold. Well, it did take hold, and so now it, you know, you wonder if you know, the President Biden should have made this speech several months ago, and that he needs to make it repeatedly, because the you know, the lie has really is festered and taken hold. And so I welcome the fact that it's now out in the open, and the, you know, the fight is on for our democracy.
Well, what about the idea that we constantly, the one thing that struck me about the speech when he talked about Trump was that it seems to me that we complain that the Republicans are obsessed with Donald Trump, but aren't we also as Democrats obsessed with Donald Trump? Shouldn't we move on at some point, Eleanor, and say, you know, there's something bigger than this man that we have to deal with in this national crisis that we have? I mean, that's one thing that struck me. I thought, you know, well, let me ask you this question, because you're a journalist, you work with words. By the way, I know you work for Newsweek, and the first guy I ever worked for was Jimmy Carter, and I know you covered him extensively and were a White House correspondent. So let me ask you about the lexicon, the words that we use today. When I listened to CNN over the week, and they talked about January 6th, the Democrats called it an insurrection and a riot. The Republicans called it a protest and protesters. We called, the Democrats called the perpetrators and insurrectionists. And, you know, and the Republicans used the language of, you know, that these were like civil rights protesters. You know, these were like the people that walked across the Pettus Bridge. Don't we have to change the language that we use? Would that
I don't think we have to change the language that we use, but there's a very good review of some books on the insurrection and on the potential of the Civil War. It was in the I think it was in the Post today, and it's the first paragraph was that the words you use to describe January 6th say a lot about you politically. And you can see by President Biden used the word insurrection, I believe it was 17 times in that speech. So I think, you know, Democrats clearly view it as insurrection, and so did most Republicans immediately after January 6th. There's been an attempt to rewrite what happened on that day to say, well, it was a protest that just got out of hand. Well, the 1-6 committee is nowhere near issuing its final report, but some of its preliminary findings are that 1-6 was not a one-off event. There was a lot of planning that went into it, and we need to know more about that planning. And it looks like it really was an active attempt by the former president to maintain his hold on the White House. I mean, there were legal papers written. There were various attempts by numerous people to portray what went on in the various states as somehow there was illegal behavior, which was not the case. So it was not simply a one-off. And this article in the Post that reviews a book about civil wars and how they're started and what we can do to prevent them is a warning to, I think, to all of us as we look around at the changes that are being made at the state level in critical states that would allow state officials to file an alternate set of electors if they don't like the outcome of the 2024 election. So, I mean, this is serious business going on, and I don't think it's time to just say, oh, let's just move on. You can't ignore what happened and what is currently happening. But you also have to do other things, obviously. You don't want to be overly focused on the former president, because he is somebody who thrives on media attention to the extent that he can get it.
I think we missed that boat back in 2016 when the Democrats, let's put it this way, which is what Mike was saying, you know, they're also obsessed with him somehow. But CNN, that's all they would cover during the primaries. And you know, I remember watching CNN one time, and I thought I was going to get some coverage on Kasich. And all I got was this reporter on the tarmac waiting for Trump's plane to land. And this was early on in the primaries. And that is all they did. That's what CNN cover was cover him. And so right. You wonder, is it the media or the citizens? You know, chicken or egg? Is the media taking the easy approach and feeding voters cheap junk food to a populace that's already bereft of solid knowledge, which you're referring to, Eleanor, the facts?
One media executive said he, at the time, that he didn't know if Donald Trump was good for the country, but he was sure good for the media's bottom line, especially yes. CNN and television. You're exactly right about that. I think the media does have some culpability here, and are trying to figure out a way to cover what's legitimate about what Trump is doing, and without getting caught up in whatever his latest scam is.
Right.
Well, and I was.
Excuse me. I'm getting over. I guess bronchitis, which I caught from a 3-year-old grandchild. She had a cold, but for me, it's
3-year-olds.
Yes, exactly. They're walking germ manufacturers.
Yes.
Yeah, they're petri dishes with legs. I remember
right, exactly.
Our kids were little. We all got sick. We all got, I forget what we got, but they had to vaccinate. They had to medicate us all because we were passing it around between the entire family. But yeah, I was going to say I was in Iowa for the caucuses in 2016, and we went to the Trump Party. And I don't know if you remember that Trump lost the Iowa caucuses. Mm-hmm. He lost them, I think, to Ted Cruz. But anyway, we went, and we had come from, different celebrations, like the Clinton celebration and, you know, other things. And we went into the Trump celebration, and there were at least five times as many cameras at event that there was at any other event we went to. We were amazed. And then when he lost, and it became obvious that he lost, his people, even at his celebration, started to get violent about it. We left because we were, as Democrats, we were worried about, you know, it was a little obvious that we were out of place, as I was there with two black interns. And they constituted 50% of all the African Americans that were in a room of 500 people. You know, I mean, there weren't a lot of black people there. But let me ask you a question about being on the McLaughlin group. You know, it seemed to me that there was such a great interaction of people between, you know, the conservatives who were on the show, and you and Pat Buchanan and John McLaughlin. Why don't we see more of that today in journalism?
Right. You're
well, you know, John, well, first of all, John died in 2016. We survivors did try to recreate the sort of the feel of the McLaughlin group, which was a kind of a spirited contest of views. But that was good-natured, and it was clear that we were friends and that sort of thing. And anyway, we had a good gig on Sinclair, and they they were looking for a merger, which everyone assumed the Trump administration would approve. Mm-hmm. And that would have put us on their stations throughout the country. And then the Trump administration, the FCC, turned down their bid. So that was the first blow. I think it was the right decision by the FCC, by the way, but it didn't help us. And then we were on Channel 8 for a while, and then the pandemic hit, and we went virtual, and it was just very hard to get any kind of advertising base. And so, you know, I think we had a good long run, and it was a lot of fun. And but I think bringing it back was too high a hurdle. So it's over. But what you have on cable TV now is a lot of back and forth, and not as much reporting as I would like. I think, you know, it's cheaper for the cable networks to just have talking heads battle mm-hmm. it out than to go out and really cover stories. And I think that's been driven home to those of us in the, you know, the East Coast media circles, how little we know or understand about what's going on in much of the country. And I think newspapers have tried to breach that more seriously than television has. And you know, most people get their news in kind of quick hits. So, you know, the middle of the country is called flyover country for a reason. I mean, people don't much pay attention. And then it comes as a big shock when we see some of these states getting redder and redder and people getting more polarized. And so we should be able to figure out a way to heal the very bitter divisions in the country. But, I mean, Joe Biden was elected on a promise that he would try to do that. And I do think he has tried. He mm-hmm. hasn't met with a whole lot of success. They did pass the infrastructure bill, which both parties need and the country needs, people, and that was a good thing. But there are a lot of other problems that need to be addressed, that you need to really do it on a bipartisan basis. And bipartisanship really does seem to be impossible to achieve at a level where you can overcome that 60-vote threshold for the filibuster, which is why you have now a big press, press by the White House and the Senate Democrats to try to do away with the filibuster. Because if you're never going to be able to reach 60, you're basically, you might as well shut down the Senate. Can't do anything.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the when you use the word that friendship, that you were obviously friends on the show, I think that's so important, because that's the problem. That I think that one of the problems we have today is that you tell me you're a Democrat and I know everything about you. I tell you I'm a Republican, you know everything about me. You know, we really don't connect much anymore, which is one of the reasons that on my show, you know, I wanted to have Marilia as a co-host, because Marilia and I are friends. Marilia was appointed by two Republican presidents to different offices. I've been a Democrat my whole life, but we don't have any problem. We don't agree on everything, but we have respect for each other, and that's really
absolutely.
I think it's really missing in his respect for
well,
for both sides.
I think it was pretty startling to see Liz Cheney, accompanied by her father, at the 1/6 commemoration in the Congress, and you know, Democrats coming up to shake Dick Cheney's hand, or maybe fist bump, I don't know. And he was once considered Darth Vader, and certainly mm-hmm. I don't think anybody is applauding his decisions he made to for the Bush administration to invade Iraq. But he still respects the fact that in a democracy, and in a republic, somebody wins and somebody loses, and there's a peaceful exchange of power, you know, and so he certainly, I thought his presence was welcome, in the Capitol, and it was a nice moment.
It was bad
that he and his daughter were the only Republicans who were there.
Exactly right. That was pathetic, wasn't it? They're all drinking Trump's Kool-Aid, and I just don't understand why. I mean, obviously, we know why. It's so they can get voted. But at some point, you have got to let go and think, what is more important, my integrity? Even that, you would think that they would think about, but that's gone.
Right, right. What do you think about Liz Cheney's bid for re-election? I mean, she, you know, that Wyoming only has one member of Congress because they don't, it's not a very populated state. And it is a whoever gets the plurality in a very crowded primary, I understand, wins. So I think she still could win, but I don't know if you thought about that. If she loses her seat, what does that say? If she is able to retain her seat and continue, what does that say? And does she have a political future as somebody who's identified as a Republican? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it may be time for Liz Cheney to think about declaring herself as an independent to avoid the primary. I don't know if she loses. I think it's a terrible blow because it reinforces the idea that you've got to be a Trumper to get past the primary. You know, I think a lot of these people feel that they don't really stand behind Trump, but they understand that they need to get through the primary before they can get elected. In the District of Columbia, if you win the Democratic primary, you go out on election day and give out donuts. That's what I do to campaign workers, because no person that's ever won the Democratic primary has ever lost the general election, which is a problem for us sometimes on the Hill. But you know, so I think it would be horrible if she loses the Republican primary. And you can bet some Trumpers are going to run against her, right? So, I think that's very tough. And she may try to think of some alternative strategy to get around being primary down.
I think in November, at poll ratings of or approval ratings of around 19%. And I remember Trump lit into her about that, because her approval ratings are only 19%. That was back, I think, in November.
Well,
I think the Republican Party in Utah, didn't they censure her or something?
Yes.
But, you know, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, because Alaska is a very independent state, she ran for re-election as an independent, and they had to spell her name, and Murkowski's not that easy a name to spell in order for the votes to count. And she pulled it off. She won as an independent. She's facing a very tough situation coming up in November.
We saw it with Susan Collins, too, in Maine, who was a relatively popular politician, and she was hanging on by her fingernails.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought she wasn't going to get elected.
Yes.
Because of her, you know, her closeness to Trump, you know, they nailed her because Maine is, you know, even the Republicans in Maine, much like the Republicans in Washington, D.C., tend to be way more liberal than the average Republican.
Right.
And, you know, and she almost didn't make it being, because of her association with Trump. So, yeah, I think the 2022 is going to tell us a lot. I hope that we can hold on to the House because it's a slim majority. As you've already said, Eleanor, I believe that it's going to be a long time before we get 60 Democrats in the United States Senate. But I don't know what to say at this point. You know, I told you before we got on the air that my family never asked for my political opinion anymore, because I was the guy in 2016 that said, Trump could never possibly get elected. It was just outside the realm. I've been in politics 40 years, and I can tell you there's no way this guy can get elected president. And, you know, obviously, that one of the exciting things about politics, I think, is you never – it's really hard to predict things. And I think
– Well, the Republicans gain control of the House, which now looks like very much within their reach because they only need to pick up 5 seats, and they've almost done that with redistricting. Yeah. They are likely to return the favor and impeach President Biden. I mean, they view – Trump's impeachment as something that was politically motivated and was groundless and all of that, and so they would return the favor and do it with Biden. I mentioned that to my son who was visiting for Christmas, and he said, "Teach him for what?" And, you know, and there doesn't have to be a reason. That's the whole point. I mean, the Republicans are willing to cross many lines. They'll find a reason. Now,
right.
They'll never convict him, but they could make a whole lot. They could just turn a body that isn't functioning very well into something that's totally dysfunctional. I mean, that's my concern. And if they don't go through with impeachment, you know, there will be lots of investigations of this, that, and the other if they get power. I don't see them, you know, trying to do any legislation, not with a Democrat in the White House, and they didn't do much legislation when they had the White House in both houses of Congress. They did the tax cuts, which they didn't pay for, and which they did through reconciliation, which are two things that Democrats are getting criticized for by using that reconciliation process so that you can get through with 51 votes. And not fully paying for the Build Back Better bill, although it's mostly paid for, which is unusual for Congress. Anyway, the taunts go back and forth between the two parties. And if you're somebody out in the country and you're just trying to get through the day and take care of your kids and keep your job and all that, it's just like so much noise. And the Democrats don't do well when it's considered like there's nothing but noise coming out of Washington.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you're right on about impeachment. We should remember that Andrew Johnson was impeached for a violation of the Tenure of Office Act. He fired a postal worker who had tenure. And that was the basis on which he was impeached. So it really doesn't, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to make it to start the process, right? It's more
right, political. Exactly. You mentioned the Postal Service. I live obviously in the District of Columbia. I got a mail delivery today for the first time in a week or 10 days.
Wow!
Apparently, the mail has been piling up in the Brentwood counting station or whatever, and there were only 4 workers there out of I don't know how many, but everybody was kind of down with COVID, and so literally no mail until today, and then I got a pile of mail today, and but all in the Northwest listserv, you know, people have been blaming Louis DeJoy, the postmaster, Postal Service, who was a Trump appointee. It's apparently not his fault. It's COVID. COVID is you know, reaching workers in just about every facet. In the dispute over the schools in Chicago and I think in Wisconsin about whether to keep them open, and the teachers' unions resisting, wanting to go virtual because of the surge in Omicron. I think it was the head of the teachers union in Wisconsin who said, you know, if you open the schools, where are you going to get the people to, where are you going to get the hundreds of thousands of teachers and personnel to staff the schools? Because everybody's got COVID. I mean, it really is sweeping through the country. here in January as we start this year.
And, you know, I got to tell you, my wife, who's the head librarian at a high school in Virginia, was just informed that she'll be expected to teach classes. I mean, she does teach classes in the library, but she's gonna be expected to abandon her teaching schedule and fill in because there's so few teachers, and they're even using, you know, maintenance personnel, janitors, okay, and other right. people just to watch the classrooms because they have so many people out. Well, yeah, and, you know, I don't get it, Eleanor. Marilia's a scientist. Maybe she can explain it to me. But when you constantly turn on the TV and hearing that 70% of all the COVID cases in hospitals are people that are not vaccinated, I just don't understand. You know, I have people in my family, not in my immediate family, but in my extended family, I have a nephew that refuses to get vaccinated, whose mother is a nurse, and right. I really don't get that, you know.
You don't even need to know science. The vaccines yield results, and that's what the problem is.
Yeah.
And Omicron is extremely transmissible, so the numbers go up. Luckily, it doesn't have so much pathogenicity as the Delta or the previous one, but it doesn't mean that we're home safe, because what it means right. is it's mutating and mutating, and who knows what's going to come up. The more the virus right. circulates in the population, the more mutations we have, and it's the draw, it's the, you know, throw of the dice. What's going to come up? What's the next one? We don't know.
Right.
Well, I got to tell you, we're starting to run out of time here. One thing that I want to say to you is that, yes, I mourn the loss of the McLaughlin group, because I think, you know, the fact that you were friends and you could have these discussions really said a lot. And I got to tell you that one of my favorite, and I'm pretty sure this was on the McLaughlin group, one of my favorite quotes was Jack Germond Clinton said he smoked but he didn't inhale, who made the comment that he couldn't vote for Bill Clinton because he couldn't vote for a guy that was too stupid to figure out how a joint worked. And you know, I mean, he said it tongue-in-cheek, but I was a Clinton a delegate. I love Bill Clinton. But, yeah, somebody should have pointed that out, right? Like, come on, Bill. You smoked but you didn't inhale. Come on. You know, so it's important to say those things, I think. And Germond had a lot of them, as you well know. But I miss
McLaughlin. When I first started doing the show, he would always be sitting there ahead of time. He'd be either doing a crossword puzzle or he'd be working on his racing form, the horses he was going to bet on. And, you know, I'd be diligently reading the newspaper, the New York Times, or some clips or whatever, and he'd look over at me and he said, Eleanor, it's just television. It goes out there and breaks into a million pieces. It doesn't have the power of the written word. Well, I'd like to believe that, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he denigrated television, but he certainly enjoyed the time that he spent on it. He was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I think he embodied what he said, because every time you would see him, he was leaning back on his chair as if he was really not into it. You know what I mean? I mean,
oh yeah, and the chair permanently is bent. Actually, the chair kept leaning even after long after he left the show.
Well, Eleanor Cliff, thank you so much for taking 55 minutes out of your day to be with us. We so much appreciate your input. I wish you a happy new year. Thank you, Marilia, once again for being on the air with me. And we leave you with a song. We leave every week with a song, usually dedicated to our guests. This is an oldie but a goodie by the Turtles. Somebody suggested I play Eleanor Rigby, and I thought, playing a song in your honor about a depressed woman who was lonely and wasn't appropriate. So we picked this song by the Turtles. I hope you like it. It's from the 1960s. Here's Eleanor by the Turtles. We'll see you next week.